From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn, but he'll join me to look at how this Sunday's Academy Awards are shaping up. Also today, Sting talks about how his musical, The Last Ship, is rooted in his own childhood.
At the time, I didn't appreciate it, but I was brought up in a surreal industrial environment. Massive ships, armies of people going to serve those ships. And it was an epic. It had this quality about it, which is kind of operatic.
And we'll experience World War I through the ears of the Oscar-nominated sound team behind 1917. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. But John is here with me to talk about this weekend's Academy Awards and how they're shaping up. Hey, John.
Hey, Stephen.
So I know you're also working on The Frame Oscar special today, so thanks for taking the time. So the Oscars will be handed out on the heels of two other big film award ceremonies this past weekend, the British Academy Film Awards, or BAFTAs, and the Writers Guild of America Awards. Looking at those results, how reliable do you think either are in terms of forecasting Oscar winners?
Very reliable, unless they're not.
Yes.
I know that seems like a not honest answer, but it is true. There's always going to be one or two surprises in any award show. I'm not sure there's going to be one in a major category. The people who won the BAFTA Awards for acting, I think with a lot of certainty, are probably going to win the acting awards at the Oscars. Mm. And that would be Joaquin Phoenix for his lead role in Joker, Brad Pitt for his supporting part in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Renee Zellweger for her lead role in Judy, and Laura Dern for her supporting role in Marriage Story. I don't think there are a lot of people who think any of those people aren't going to repeat at the Academy Awards. So I think those four who won the BAFTAs are probably going to win at the Academy Awards on Sunday.
The film Jojo Rabbit is a favorite for adapted screenplay winner at the Oscars. It won a BAFTA over the weekend. What other Oscar categories feel like there's a pretty clear winner to you?
You know, outside of Jojo for adapted screenplay and Parasite for original screenplay, I think the big drama on Sunday is going to be in two races. One is for Best Director, and I think that's between Sam Mendes, who directed 1917, and Bong Joon-ho, who directed Parasite. And I think it's very possible that Bong Joon-ho could win the Directing Academy Award and 1917 could win the Best Picture Award. I think there's a slim chance Parasite could win both. I think there's a good chance Sam Mendes could win for directing and 1917 could win for picture as well.
Why do you think it's unlikely for Parasite to win in both categories?
I think the Academy, as much as it's tried to diversify its membership, still has a very kind of old-fashioned way of thinking about movies. In 1917, for all of its strengths, and I would say some of its weaknesses, is a very old-fashioned movie.
Yeah.
I will ask you this question, but I suspect you know the answer. How many foreign language movies have won the Best Picture Oscar? I'm going to give you a hint. It starts with zero.
Yeah, that's right.
Zero. So, I mean, if Parasite wins that award for Best Picture, it will become the first foreign language film to win the top prize. But it would also represent, to me, the change in the Academy membership, because Parasite is not only a movie in Korean, it is a crazy, way out there movie. I think it's fantastic, and it represents kind of a new generation of filmmaking, whereas 1917 is a movie that could have been made, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
It very much felt that way to me in watching most of all the other major nominees. Parasite is the one that really stood out and for me made the other ones, the other films, The Irishman and such films, just seem like Hollywood of yesteryear.
I think that's true. And I think one of the things that 1917 has going for it is the craft of filmmaking. It was shot by Roger Deakins, who is going to win the Oscar for cinematography. Mark that on your office pool ballot now. As one take, and I think the craft of it is remarkable. But if you start looking back over the last 3 years, the Best Picture winners, Green Book, Shape of Water, Moonlight, they are all about people who are marginalized, people who are trying to fit into society. Mm-hmm. 1917 does not check that box. Parasite does.
Parasite does.
Jojo Rabbit does. Mm-hmm. But you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Speaking of diversity, Joaquin Phoenix delivered a very pointed speech at the BAFTAs last night after winning Best Actor for The Joker.
I think that it is the obligation of the people that have created and perpetuate and benefit from a system of oppression to be the ones that dismantle it. So that's on us.
He called out what is a pretty stunning lack of diversity among this year's nominees. Could we see this theme carry over into the Academy Awards on Sunday?
I think so, and I think it would be odd if it wasn't. I mean, the BAFTAs had 20 acting nominees. There is not a single person of color among the nominees. The Academy Awards has one, Cynthia Erivo from Harriet, as a person of color among all the 20 acting nominees. And Joaquin Phoenix said, not only this is a problem, but also people like me, meaning white actors who are leading casts, have to do something better. And Joaquin Phoenix has never been very comfortable as a public speaker. It does feel like he's really honing in on a message. And that message, I think, is really finding an audience.
Well, it's one thing to say such things during an acceptance speech, but what can he do? How much power can he exert on the set to really make these changes?
Any actor could say, I have a choice between movie A and movie B. Movie A is directed by a straight white guy. Movie B is directed by a person of color who is LGBTQ. I'm making up a hypothetical, but you can say, I'm going to choose one over the other. Or when I get on set, I want to have a person as a co-star who's a person of color. Or why is a woman not shooting this film? Or can we bring in this person as our editor? There are certain things that actors with clout can do. And if they don't get what they want, they can walk away from the project. And I think that's what's going to happen for any real change to come about, because the actors have a tremendous amount of power, and they typically don't exert it.
Well, John, you're just back from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. What's the big news coming out of there, aside from you not getting sick, that is, in terms of breakout films and distribution deals?
For the record, I got sick for about 4 hours,
okay,
which is a long time for me. There will be some movies that we'll be hearing from in the months ahead. The big winner among dramatic films was a Korean coming-of-age movie called Minari. There are also some notable documentaries, Boys State, a movie about a group of kids putting together a kind of hypothetical government that, I will say, spoiler, works a little bit better than the government we have, sold for $12 million to Apple. It also won the Grand Jury Prize. There's a documentary about disability rights called Crip Camp that won the Audience Award. We're going to be hearing a lot about these movies in the months and weeks to come. And who knows, we might be talking about them next year at the Academy Awards.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Stephen.
Coming up on The Frame, my backstage visit with Sting at the Amundsen Theater, where he's performing in The Last Ship. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. While the jukebox musical may have taken over Broadway, Sting has made it clear that his greatest hits will not. But the pop star has relaunched The Last Ship, his 2014 musical based on a collection of songs that explore the themes of his youth and of British labor strife. The Last Ship, now at the Amundsen Theater, unfolds in the small shipbuilding town of Wallsend, where Sting grew up. In this revised version, he takes the stage as Jackie White, an aging shipyard foreman fighting to keep his workers employed long enough to build one last ship. While the musical is not a literal autobiography of Sting's youth, he did tell me that a difficult relationship with his father was a catalyst.
My dad was, an engineer. Mm-hmm. He built turbines for ships. His father was a shipwright, too. And, grandfathers worked in shipping. And I wanted a classical education. I won a scholarship to be taught Latin and Greek, history, philosophy, and he wanted me to have a technical education so he could be doing something that he understood.
So
I could be
doing something. It wasn't necessarily in that industry.
No, just something that he understood.
Yeah.
And so, Dead Man's Boots is about that conflict that arises when a father's love is seen from the son's point of view as overbearing and controlling.
I had a plan of my own, and I'd quit this place when I came of age, September. These dead man's boots know their way down the hill. They could walk there themselves, and they probably...
And conversely, a son's ambition can seem like some pie-in-the-sky fantasy.
And you'd never see me walking in these dead man's boots.
So that is that one of the tropes of the play, is that conflict between fathers and sons, and it's common. But in my case, it was a reality for me.
Yeah, and it's not just that the character in The Last Ship doesn't want to go into shipbuilding. Is that he's very clear, he's almost rebelling against it. He's rejecting it outright.
Well, the shipyard was a dangerous dark, frightening place. And, you know, I used to watch armies of men, thousands of men walk down that hill every day. Mm. And as proud as they were of the what they were building, it was also hell. And many of them got, you know, mesothelioma from working with asbestos.
This is the thing that I find interesting in this piece, in that it's very clear that it's dangerous, that many men don't want to work there, but there's a great pride in it as well, and almost a spirituality. And Jackie speaks in terms of ships as great cathedrals. And so you...
Well, I was not immune myself to this, the symbolism of this. You know, it had an epic quality. And, you know, at the time, I didn't appreciate it. But I was brought up in a surreal industrial environment, massive ships, armies of people going to serve those ships. And it was an epic. It had this quality about it, which is kind of operatic.
Very much so.
So the men felt that too. As much as they hated the work and they hated working in all weathers, they were also immensely proud of what they achieved.
And the ship sets sail and the tale gets told. And the only life we've known is in the shipyard.
Steel in the stockyard, iron in the soul. We'll get the bastard finished and we'll end up on the door.
Some of the biggest vessels ever constructed on planet Earth were made on the end of my street.
One that was used to rescue survivors of the Titanic, I understand.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Women have a strong voice in and presence in The Last Ship, and that's something that you and director Lauren Campbell, I think, updated for this version.
Yeah, I think the early iterations of the play were very men-orientated. Mm. You know, it was mainly men who worked in the shipyards, and so that was probably understandable, but then
sure.
I think in the current iteration, the agency of women becomes so important because the men can't really find their way out of the problem.
Show some respect on this deck for the dear departed. Gather yous round, let's be bound by the work he started.
And so they take over. And it's basically, it's a grand gesture here at the end of the play. You know, we launch a ship and it's a statement of our individuality, of our collective, you know, sense of worth. And it's a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
We're not saving the shipbuilding industry at all. We're just saying, we're here and this is what we do and we are proud of what we did. We're not dispensable or expendable, which is what we're accused of.
We'll splice a rope and tether, and though we won't know whether it's fair or stormy weather, we'll quit this key and we'll cast this net of souls upon the sea.
And during the late 1980s, when the labor strikes were happening in Britain and mining and shipping and so forth, women also were playing a pretty prominent role in the protests, yes?
Very much. I mean, you know, the socioeconomic history is much more extant in this version of the play. You know, the conservative, the Tory government wanted to break the power of the unions. And, you know, you can argue about the rights and the wrongs of that. But in order to do that, they had to destroy the industry. So they shut the coal mines.
Mm.
They shut the shipyards. Mm. Destroyed our manufacturing, which is kind of a strange way to go, just to break the power of the unions. And, you know, Britain is now this economy that survives really on being, you know, it's a place for money to come, but we don't make anything. And that's a loss.
There was some, I think, concern or critique that in the first iteration of The Last Ship that it was just maybe too English for audiences outside of England. I did not find this to be the case with this iteration of Last Ship, but...
It's like saying a Western is too American. You
yeah,
know?
Right.
It has a universal theme, you know, which people in this country and in across Europe will recognize as when communities are based upon one industry, what happens to that community when you lose the dignity of work, your identity? What happens to that community? And we know what happens. You end up with alcoholism, drug addiction, domestic violence, families breaking up, you know, society breaks up. These economic theories, which I would call abstract, took out the value of community from the equation. And when you take that part of the equation out, you end up with something very bleak. because I studied economics, and economics at a basic level is about community. Mm-hmm. I will make something and I will sell it to you. You mm-hmm. make something and I will buy it from you. That is community. Take away community, what do you have? If, you know, armies of people with nothing to do.
And I think you're going to be taking the production to the city of Detroit as well, which of course is world famous for its car manufacturing.
Well, I think it will resonate very deeply in Detroit, but surprisingly and happily, even here in, you know, comfortable Los Angeles,
certainly,
it seems to be resonating as well. I think there's an anxiety in the world at the moment that is across the board.
Economic anxiety.
Economic, philosophical, however you want to say it, people are anxious about what the future is. So that's what they're feeding into. I'm making the play sound rather bleak. There are bleak elements to it, but it's also a very beautiful love story, mm-hmm. which I think saves the day.
When we dance,
how did you view Wall's End when you left and embarked on, you know, an acting and music career?
Well, that's the other paradox. You know, I did everything in my power to escape Wall's End. I got a scholarship to a school, and I aspired to become middle class. And, you know, I became successful, and, you know, I have all the trappings of success. And yet the thing that formed me, that community that formed me, I tend to owe a debt to. And this play really is me trying to honor that community, trying to pay back what they gave me, a sense of self, but also the engine that allowed me to escape. Mm. That's the strange paradox. So I love where I come from. I'm glad I escaped. At the same time, I need to tell that story as a kind of soul debt.
Was there any hesitancy, though, to do so because the material is so personal? It's based on such personal experiences and people who were very much a part of your youth. Was it difficult then to not only explore that material creatively, but to put it out there in the world?
I think I revealed more about myself than I might have intended to, because it's a little bit like going to the psychiatrist. You know, they put you on a couch and say, well, okay, your early life. Let's talk
about
that.
That's what we're doing now, yes.
I put myself on the couch, and a lot of the memories were not pleasant. I had to dredge up things that I would have, you know, been happy to just suppress. And yet, having done it and to be performing it here, it is a great release for me. It's catharsis. So it's helped me a great deal.
I know that you were experiencing some writer's block prior to really breaking through with this material. What do you think was behind that?
Well, you go through periods of, you know, fallow periods where you have to be on input. You can't be on output all the time. It's just a natural cycle. But this was a long period when I wasn't writing, had no interest in writing. And yet when I decided that I would do this, the songs poured out of me. I described it as projectile vomiting. These songs were fully formed in me, and the characters, couplets, ideas, as if they'd been just waiting.
What do you got? All you men, what's fit and able? What do you got?
For the thrilling in your neck.
What do you got? When you're laid out on a table and the snapping of a cable when the ringing hits the deck.
It was a very odd experience, very heartening experience. And I wrote most of these lyrics in the space of a month.
And then once that, you know, got out of your system, you were able to continue to write in other material as well?
I'm still writing songs. It's rare, but, you know.
Well, no, the reason I ask is because I read that you had a prior, pretty severe case of writer's block prior to The Soul Cages, which also explores some of this time in your life as well.
Yeah, I explored some of those issues on The Soul Cages, which, you know, coincided with the death of my parents. So the shipyard, the death of the shipyard was a metaphor, if you like, for the demise of my parents and my town at the same time. So I've been writing this piece for a long time.
Sting, thank you so much for joining us.
It was
my
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Whatever you've done, and whatever the
station, Sting's The Last Ship is at the Amundsen Theater through February 16th. Up next on The Frame, recreating what World War I sounded like for the film 1917. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, in for John Horn. As you heard earlier, the Academy Awards happened this Sunday. In the technical categories, picking the winners for Best Sound Mixing and Best Sound Editing is often a subjective choice. But for the Oscar-nominated sound team behind the film 1917, subjectivity was the order of the day. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving has the story.
My name's Stuart Wilson. I was the production sound mixer on the film. That is, I was recording the dialogue, etc., during the filming.
Hi, I'm Rachel Tate. I'm the dialogue and ADR supervisor on 1917.
Hi, I'm Oliver Tani. I'm the supervising sound editor on 1917.
All right. Say the Bush have gone. 9 miles will take us, what, 6 hours? 8 at the very most. So we've got time to wait until the sun sets.
It's enemy territory. We've got no idea what we're walking into.
Blake, if we're not clever about this, no one will get to your brother.
Yeah, Sam had a very clear idea about how he wanted the film to sound. He wanted to entirely focus in on Schofield and Blake, the two main characters, and he wanted to use sound to do that. He called it a vignette, like in an old photo, you have the browning around the edge. He wanted to heighten the sounds that they would hear rather than all the sounds that you could possibly hear in that soundscape, like most films. If you had crowd actors a couple of rows back, you probably usually in a film you'd cover that, you'd put it in there and just mix it a little lower. But actually, if they didn't hear it, we didn't put it there. Conversely, when they are on their own, we hear every little sound around them, like in No Man's Land. They are very vulnerable. It's a very exposed area. And because of that, we're pushing in on every detail of their footsteps, their breaths. Everything's very clear, maybe more so than you would do on a normal film.
Emotionally, it's in the style of the film, there's a very pure, simple connection with our two characters and their innocence in their situation. And so a lot of the emotion comes simply from hearing, you know, their breath, their anxiety, and the way they're speaking during it. And sometimes when they're in the trenches, you don't see that they're sloshing through water, but you hear it and you're getting the kind of misery of the situation and how tough it is. And when they encounter carrion birds or corpses on the battlefield, the emotion is how they react and how they experience that, because we're always hearing them, we're always with them, we're feeling that through their feeling that. So it's a very pure, simple thing, rather than trying to contrive an emotion through adding effects.
Jesus. Look at this. It's massive.
It was difficult with the limitations of how this had to be filmed. It's not like you have the usual where you have a wide shot, then you go in for the two shot, then you have the over-the-shoulder shot. It wasn't like that. It was one camera the whole time, either in front or just behind, very close proximity to these guys most of the way through. And because of that, you had the camera operator. Sometimes you had two or three other people, maybe more, running alongside with them. So if you imagine the muddy trenches at the beginning, there's no way you're not going to pick up maybe 10 feet in boots in the mud as well as their voices. And you could just say, fine, let's just strip everything out and re-record the voices. But Sam is a very performance-orientated guy. He's from a theatre background. He doesn't want to redo it all. He wants the performance he signed off on. So my job chiefly was to get right in there and save all that I could from production. Actually, he saved it all apart from two lines in the end.
It's a straight shot to a coast.
Good.
On this particular project, you are flipping between subjective and objective as well. So most of the time you're sticking with them, and you really are wanting to sell. The audience are feeling exactly what they're feeling. You're helping guide them, look at something on the screen that they would be looking at, such as the biplane dogfight. We played that very diffuse and very distant so that you're watching them watching the dogfight as opposed to watching the dogfight directly.
Is that our friends again?
Looks like it. Dogfight. Who's winning? Us, I think.
Yeah, I think the thing we're just pleased with overall is Sam wanting us to feel that the world was being revealed to us at the same time it was being revealed to Schofield and Blake, and the discipline we had to kind of have to do that.
That was the sound team behind the movie 1917. The film's Oscar nominations include sound editing and sound mixing. The story was produced by the Frame contributor Tim Grieving. And for what it's worth, the 1917 team has already won the award for Outstanding Achievement in Sound Editing for Dialogue and ADR from the Motion Picture Sound Editors Organization. And that's all for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. John Horn is back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.